Welcome to this episode of Season 4 of The Common Bridge, where policy and current events are discussed in a fiercely nonpartisan manner. The host, Richard Helpe, is a philanthropist, entrepreneur, and political analyst who has reached over 3.5 million listeners, viewers, and readers around the world. The Common Bridge is available on the Substack website and the Substack app. Just search for The Common Bridge. You can find the program on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts. The Common Bridge draws guests and audiences from across the political spectrum, and we invite you to become a free or paid subscriber on your favorite medium.
Hello, welcome to The Common Bridge. We have a return guest today. Very interesting topic. We're going to be talking about big tech. We're going to be talking about the government's role in perhaps controlling that big tech. And we have an expert with us today back on The Common Bridge, Adam Kovacevich. Adam, it's good to see you. How you been?
Great. Thanks for having me back.
Great. Adam, of course, runs the Chamber of Progress. It's a center-left trade association. It's funded by the largest of the big tech players from A to Z, including Airbnb and Amazon to Google to Meta to Zillow and just about everything in between. You can find them at progresschamber.org. progresschamber.org. Been a lot in the news about information, misinformation, disinformation, content moderation. And in episode 177 of The Common Bridge back in October of 2022, we talked about the role of technology, specifically big tech in our lives, and now finding a place where it could be abused for power versus used to enhance our lives. And I hope that you read that or listen to it in our archives. So Adam, since our last conversation, big tech has had a little more transparency. I mean, transparency with the old definition of transparency. So we've had the Twitter files and through Matt Taibbi, Barry Weiss, and Michael Schellenberger. We've talked a little bit more about the shadow banning that's gone on. And just to me, it looks like any other kind of creeping corruption. You know, first it's a one-off, couple more exceptions than a standard practice, and then an overreach. But today we're going to be talking about the FTC and Amazon. The FTC's, the Federal Trade Commission, is looking at Amazon. What is it that the FTC is alleging today, and why should this be a concern to us?
Well, I think in some ways this goes back several years, probably about 6 years. Lina Khan, who is now the chairwoman of the Federal Trade Commission, 6 years ago was a law student and wrote a paper called Amazon's Antitrust Paradox, which looked at Amazon's behavior and sort of said, look, under traditional applications of antitrust law, Amazon's behavior, you know, Amazon has a pro-consumer justification for its behavior, but she was arguing that there were aspects of Amazon's behavior that hurt sellers, for example, marketplace sellers on Amazon service, as well as potentially other retailers, and that policymakers, regulators ought to take a broader, more expansive approach to antitrust law in a way that would deal with what she saw as these problems from quote-unquote problems from Amazon. So flash forward. You know, now she is the chair of the FTC, and last year she directed that several attorneys at the FTC spend more of their time investigating Amazon, looking at their behavior, and it's now been rumored for several months and been reported that they are on the verge of filing an antitrust lawsuit of their own against Amazon, which will likely focus on Amazon Prime. And I'm happy to get into the details of what we expect.
What I'd like to hear is, what is it the FTC is alleging? Who's harmed? What's the remedy that they're talking about? And what's the response from the Chamber of Progress in general, if there is one? And then what's Amazon saying?
Yeah. Well, based on based on press reports at this point that focus on what the complaints are likely to be, there's really three aspects to it. One is focused on the Amazon Prime bundle. So if you are an Amazon Prime subscriber right now, you get discounts, you get free shipping, but you also get access to Amazon Prime Video and Amazon Photos and Amazon Books. And there's some feeling that the FTC will allege that Amazon's bundle of services is unfair to competing retailers like Walmart, Target, Costco, particularly large sort of super retailers, and that bundle of things together is anti-competitive or harmful. The second allegation has to do with Prime and how Prime works. Right now, Prime promises that a product you order through Prime that has the Prime label can get into your house within 2 days. The reason why Amazon is able to make that work is because they require that sellers in order to be eligible for Prime, participate in what's called fulfillment by Amazon. That ensures that Amazon itself keeps those goods and fulfills them and ships them to goods. They control the whole fulfillment and shipping process so that they can guarantee the product gets there. Some sellers complain about that requirement. And again, I'm happy to get into more detail, but it's very likely that Amazon, that the FTC will accuse Amazon of unfairly linking Prime to this fulfillment by Amazon service. The last area that they are expected to bring a case on is what's called the buy box. Right now, you search for, you know, blender on Amazon, and you go look on the right hand side, and there's a box that says, you know, buy it now or add to your cart. That's essentially a sale for a particular seller. You know, there might be multiple sellers of that good, but one seller is picked to have the quote unquote buy box. And Amazon essentially has certain policies that says that in order to be the buy box retailer, you have to have essentially the lowest price on the internet for a given item. And again, some have alleged problems with that. And so those are the three big areas that we're expecting them to focus on.
Well, that's really interesting that, first of all, that we have a agency of the federal government that's going to go out and protect Walmart from what sounds like competition. I mean,
especially since Walmart already has its own Amazon Prime program, which is called Walmart Plus. They offer, you know, access to Paramount Plus. They offer free shipping. You know, they offer a lot of the same benefits.
And then on the fulfillment, I guess I can see Amazon's point that, look, if I'm going to guarantee you delivery in, you know, 1 or 2 days, whatever their commitment is, yeah, I've got to be able to make good on that promise. Otherwise, you could, you know, theoretically, you could do it in a flow down contract to your suppliers, but you've got millions of suppliers you'd have to monitor. And
that's right.
You know, you're on the hook for not getting that there.
Well, and in fact, you know, it's interesting. So several years ago, about 4 or 5 years ago, Amazon introduced a program called Seller Fulfilled Prime, where they basically gave retailers in that program or sellers in that program the ability to both have their products be labeled as Amazon Prime, but also handle the shipping and fulfillment themselves. What did they find? They found that the sellers couldn't live up to the quality standards in general. And so they had to close enrollment in that program and actually rework the program to put in place certain quality standards so that they could ensure that that sellers who use that program live up to that guarantee. Otherwise, it's, you know, what the prime label is sort of useless from the perspective of consumers if it's not really getting there within 2 days.
So you're saying that the craft maker in northeastern Iowa may not be as reliable as Amazon and their technology and their distributed warehouses?
They are almost certainly not as reliable, but the point is that Amazon, and that's okay, right? When I order something from Etsy, it might take a couple weeks to get there. That's fine. I expect that. The idea, though, is that if something's going to carry the Amazon Prime label, then Amazon should be able to apply certain standards to how that good is fulfilled and shipped, just to make sure it gets there on time. That's the value proposition of Prime for consumers.
Well, I know that there's also Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren has said that she thinks it's unfair for Amazon to control the leading marketplace and sell their own products there. So they have, you know, Amazon manufactured labeled products there. It's an interesting argument. And is it terribly different than a grocery store having a house brand but still carrying Del Monte and such?
No, it's not different at all. Or Costco having, its brand, the Kirkland brand, or Walmart having Sam's brand. No, there's no difference at all. And we know that these store brands are often a really important way for consumers to save money, too, because they're not carrying the marketing costs of the kind of the prominent brands. And interestingly, this has been an area of critique of Amazon, for years now. But according to recent reports, it is not at this point part of the FTC's complaint against Amazon. I'm hopeful that it stays out of their lawsuit and hopeful that they've sort of recognized that these store brands can play a valuable role in helping consumers get goods, you know, less expensively.
Any idea what the remedy the FTC would be looking for in this?
Yeah, I think in the first case, it would be trying to kind of break apart the Prime bundle of services, right? That would presumably then raise the cost of each individual thing, right? If you cannot subscribe to Prime as we know it today, then, you know, are you going to have to start paying shipping for each individual product? It's hard to imagine that will be the consequence there. On the second point about delinking Prime with fulfillment by Amazon. One of the interesting things about that is that the European Commission, European antitrust regulators, actually struck an agreement with Amazon last summer around seller-fulfilled Prime. They said, okay, well, actually, seller-fulfilled Prime is a good idea, and we understand there need to be certain quality controls. That solved the problem in the eyes of the EU regulators, which saw, to me, shows that there is a opportunity for compromise on that issue. On the buy box issue, I think the strange thing is that I don't know what the remedy is. And if the remedy is that, you know, Amazon can't pick the lowest price seller to highlight, that seems odd to me that it would try to, you know, it would intentionally be telling, the government would be telling them that they have to pick a higher price and show a higher price to consumers. That just seems strange to me. I don't know that they've put much thought to remedies, to be honest, at this stage.
And on that buy box, I know there's allegations that you can't get into that buy box unless you purchase advertising on Amazon. Is there any substance to that notion?
Well, I think there's two different things. One is that you do see a lot of retailers advertising for certain keywords, right? So again, to use my example for blenders, when you search for a blender, you might see something that's ranked like the Amazon top choice. Maybe that's the highest, most popular item. But then ahead of that, you might see sponsored links. Those are, basically advertisements. And nobody's really alleging any problem with that. What we're really talking about is that when you open up the product page for an item for a particular blender, Cuisinart blender, let's say, is technically in the background, you might have 20 different sellers selling that blender through Amazon, but only one seller can be matched with kind of the buy box. And so understandably, the sellers who don't win the buy box are upset. They'd all like to win the buy box, but also understandably, Amazon, you know, should be able to put certain rules on essentially who's going to make the buy box. I have no reason to believe that advertising plays any role in that. I strongly suspect that's much more to do with price, quality, ratings, those kinds of things.
When I buy things on Amazon, it'll say this product is available for less money from other sellers.
Yeah, that's right.
And I sometimes investigate that. And my understanding also is that third-party merchants, that they're not allowed to sell their products on other websites at a price lower than Amazon has.
That's right.
So let's say I'm a manufacturer of insulated mugs, and I can't go on my own website and say, look, you can buy it for $5 because Amazon says the lowest we can sell it for is $5.50. I'm trying to figure out what would be the fair thing to do if someone could sell on their own website versus being forced to meet a price that Amazon sets.
Well, it's important to say that the seller sets the price. Amazon doesn't set the price. And Amazon doesn't say that you have to set the price at a certain spot. It just says that if you, the seller, are selling that good for a lower price somewhere else on the internet, you're probably not going to be featured in the buy box. Somebody else will be featured in the buy box. And that's because Amazon, as a general matter, doesn't want to, they want to be able to promise their customers that they're getting the lowest price, right, on the internet. And so there is a theory that that rule or that aspect of Amazon's criteria has forced sellers to lower their prices elsewhere on the internet. And, you know, I think it's sort of an odd argument. There's already a lawsuit against Amazon on this point by the California Attorney General. There's also a plaintiff's law firm who's been pushing this theory for a couple of years now. There was a case by the Washington, D.C. Attorney General, which was actually thrown out. And interestingly enough, it was thrown out because the judge said that it was not plausible. It was not, they hadn't provided any evidence that the central allegation that Amazon's policy had forced other people to lower their prices. So anyway, there has not a lot of evidence there.
All the things that big tech is stumbling into, some things that some people might say are outrageous, it's just odd that they're kind of picking here. I know my own personal shopping preference, and I'm a Amazon Prime user, is if I can find something not on Amazon, I'll typically go there. Some of the places, their technology is just so horrible, you can't get the product, and I won't name them. But I like to do a lot of grilling and barbecuing, and the best meat thermometer is a thing called Thermopops, but they're not on Amazon.
I purchased some lawn equipment a couple months back. Not on Amazon. It was a specialized, like a lawn fence, and had to go to a specialty retailer. So yeah, they don't have everything. I think it's a good important point.
And this other part about bundling the delivery services with the purchasing, with the marketplace, is the proposed resolution that Amazon doesn't use their own distribution?
Well, the proposed resolution is that that you as a seller could still have your product labeled Prime, even if you don't use Amazon's fulfillment service. And again, what Amazon's agreed to in Europe is essentially that. But they said, you know, we're willing to offer that so long as we can put certain rules around fulfillment by Amazon to ensure the product is getting there in time. I just mentioned that because I think it sort of shows that they're actually, if to the extent the FTC is concerned about this, I'm sure that Amazon would be willing to make that concession in the U.S. just as they've done in Europe. It seems odd this would have to come to a lawsuit. On the other hand, Chairwoman Kahn really made her reputation in going after Amazon. And so I think it's somewhat difficult for her to, you know, her sort of optics to appear overly conciliatory to Amazon, even if they're, you know, but this has been her approach through many, many situations. She'd rather sort of sue than extract a compromise.
Again, very, very odd. I mean, when we look at the intersection of government and big tech, law enforcement, regulation, this just seems like a real odd place. Is Google just too big that they just can't get their arms around that, given how much data they control and how much tracking they do? And I know they're one of your members, but it seems to me that Google would be a more readily available target, and it would make a lot more sense to break up search and marketplaces and mail and advertising and all the things that they do kind of in one bundle, looking at us each as a set of data that can be tracked and processed.
Well, in fact, there are two active federal government antitrust lawsuits against Google, too. So okay. I think... Yeah, well, one actually starts in court next week. That was a case that was launched by the Trump administration against Google over its search distribution agreement. So right now, if you open up Safari on your desktop or on your phone, Google is the default search engine right out of the box. And Google pays Apple a fair amount of money to be that default position. And they do the same thing for phone operators to be the default search on new phones. And the central allegation of the Department of Justice is that Google, that these deals should have given Google an unfair leg up. Now, I think these deals are more akin to, you know, Oreo paying a supermarket a lot of money to have a lot of shelf space. That's a pretty ordinary type of deal that we've seen. It doesn't mean that people can't pick Hydrox, right, or other kind of cookies. It just gives them a prominent position. So, but that case is going to start in court next weekend and will unfold over 8 weeks. The Department of Justice also has a lawsuit against Google over its advertising tech network and kind of an allegation that it owns and controls too many parts of the ad tech space. That case probably won't see court until next year or the year after as well. But yeah, so there are active cases there. And there's an active case against Meta by the FTC. There's a long rumored potential case against Apple. So all the big tech companies have kind of cases or prospective cases against them.
And again, it seems a little unusual that we've got one part of our government that saying we need to control these. We've got another part that's saying, you know, we want to get this geofence data from Google. And I've been doing some research leading up to our talk today that Google had a geofence warrant that gave over 5,700 phones that were in the general vicinity of the Capitol on January 6th. So it's not like, hey, we think this person's there. Can you verify it? It was just tell us everybody that was there. I think this has some civil liberties implications, and it's being directed by one arm of the government. How does this get reconciled in your world and in the world of the regulators in DC?
Well, it's a great example. I worked at Google for 12 years, and so I spent a lot of time on this question of law enforcement access. These sort of geofence warrants were becoming an increasing issue for companies to deal with. Companies would prefer law enforcement to come to them and say, okay, we have reason to believe that, you know, John Doe committed this crime. shared, you know, will you please, here's a warrant with John Doe's information. That's a lot higher standard than, you know, a geofence warrant, which says, you know, show us everybody who was in that area at the time. The company's, you know, puts the companies in an uncomfortable spot. But I do think kind of one of the things you're kind of pointing to is I think that policymakers have kind of a, I don't know, they have kind of a split relationship with particularly big tech platforms. There are some who want to break up their power, and then there's some who want to harness their power for whatever their goals are. And I think that's a, you know, kind of a shorthand there.
This is the kind of thing the newspeak, I think, is content moderation. That's newspeak for censoring. And, you know, look, we're not going to do that, saith those that we elect. But wouldn't your members, or you in particular, make a difference between a legitimate law enforcement inquiry versus the politically elected administration, you know, suggesting that Facebook or X, formerly Twitter, throttle certain content and certain speakers?
Well, I'm one who believes that content moderation is basically essential if you want to run a healthy platform. There is almost no platform that's both a successful social media business and that lets anything go, right? Maybe Parler lets anything go, but the fact is they're not a successful business. On the other end of that spectrum, Instagram, you know, has quite a bit of content moderation, and they're extremely successful as a business. So I think if you want to be particularly if you want to attract advertising, you need to have some kind of content moderation on your platform. And, you know, you can disagree about what things should be allowed or disallowed. But I think in general, it's kind of an important thing.
But Adam, the general on content moderation, and we've talked about Section 230 on our last talk and what these companies are doing as businesses. You know, I think we have an agreement that clearly illegal content, child pornography is a prime example, would have to be moderated. But this is more than moderation. This is, we don't like this group talking, so we're going to throttle them. I've seen in recent days fairly prominent political figures demonstrating that they've been shadow banned, and so that their voices can't get out there on Meta and on X. And these places are becoming the public square. And particularly, you know, we had the Biden administration just can't come right out and say, yeah, we routinely made requests to throttle content. You know, we don't have to rehash chapter and verse. We all know what they are. That, to me, is a lot different than a group inside of any of these companies saying, hey, these folks are talking about gun running, child pornography, what have you. That, to me, is like, how do we prevent that? Because we literally have to have one part of the government suing another part of the government.
Yeah, in general, there's not a lot of dispute about platforms. There isn't any dispute, really, about platforms removing illegal speech. But there's a lot of speech that somebody might say is awful but lawful. And, you know, so it does mean that platforms have to make a lot of tough decisions about allowing speech, which is legal. You know, neo-Nazi speech, you know, Holocaust denial speech. You know, Parler might allow that, but Instagram doesn't, right? And so, and that's okay for both of them to make different decisions. I don't think we have one town square. I don't love that analogy, but we certainly have room for multiple social networks that have different platforms. I think what you're pointing out is that, you know, there is a lot of effort by policymakers to what's called jawbone the platforms to take certain steps. Certainly, there's been steps by the Biden administration to do that. Certainly, the, you know, Democrats in Congress, but Republicans in Congress too. You know, during the speaker debate, came out that Kevin McCarthy's office had lobbied Twitter to restore Marjorie Taylor Greene's Twitter account. Right, so it happens on both sides. I don't love that. And I know the companies, it puts them in an awkward position. Sometimes it can be valuable for, you know, to get information from the government about new threats. For example, you know, if you saw that China was, you know, engaged in a pretty sophisticated cyber attack or spoofing regime, I think if I was Twitter or Facebook or Google, I'd want to know what the FBI knew. And that intelligence can be helpful for them. So I don't think it's as black and white as maybe some might think.
I don't think anybody's making the case that it's black and white. And I think that the point about legitimate law enforcement. So by way of example, during the Clinton administration, they put a wall up between the CIA and the FBI. And I'm trying to recall her name, Jamie, I'm blanking on her last name, but actually wrote the rule. And in hindsight, they believed that that was one of the things that let the 9/11 terrorists conduct their operation, because the CIA couldn't share what they were learning from overseas with the FBI. So we've got those legitimate criminal pursuits. But I'm just wondering, if how would your members react to differentiating between a investigation of a legitimate criminal or terrorist threat versus, hey, don't let the MAGA Republicans talk? We saw the president a year ago set the table for that. I just read this morning that we had a prominent senator talking about we want to destroy that voter block. And again, I don't agree with them, but we know that the end result of going after one philosophy is going to be all philosophies if you can exercise that kind of power. So where are your members coming down on this?
Well, I think that, again, you know, I don't think there's any hesitation to remove content that's clearly illegal. And frankly, there's not much dispute about that type of thing. That's pretty clear. Sometimes there might be a scale problem, might be a lot of it. And you work hard to try to find all that speech, but it's hard sometimes. I think that, you know, candidly, on the other side of it, I don't see platforms saying, let's silence all the MAGA speech. I see hard calls around the edges. And frankly, when there have been things, you know, for example, I mean, I think even the previous owners of Twitter said that in hindsight, their approach to the first New York Post story on Hunter Biden laptop, they handled incorrectly. And they said that they had actually handled it poorly and would not have put the label on it or restricted the access to it. And I think they reversed that pretty quickly. A lot of times these kind of things can actually generate more interest in the topic. So I think, you know, anyway, I've seen that happen quite a bit.
I think there's a thirst out there for unvarnished, clear information. And, you know, frankly, I have to tell you that when I hear the Biden administration's pronouncements on the economy, I have to kind of feel like Winston Smith did listening to the glorious crop reports in the book 1984. I mean, Americans are struggling. The dollar value is down 17% during the administration. The home mortgage costs are up 250%. We've had a credit downgrade, a lot of downward revisions after the fact. The fundamentals of the economy are not doing what they should be doing for your average American. And the spending that was packed into those bills is now still rippling through the economy, and there's still a lot more damage ahead. And it just kind of bothers me that any of these big platforms would influence the content that gets out there. I mean, it's numbers are numbers. We should be able to talk about them, not have to be flexed. And I share your point, by the way, jumping back to the New York Post. Yeah, that's a lesson learned, but that pile on 51 of the intelligence heads who bolstered the same fake story were never held accountable.
Well, I think I might disagree with you a little bit about the economy, right? So, I mean, I see positive signs. Inflation's down, real wages are up, consumer spending is up. I mean, it's actually for reasons like...
The numbers belie that on an after-tax basis. They want to say, well, inflation went from 9% to 3.25%. The 9% didn't come off. And when you look at the rules of big numbers, it's like asking someone, do you want a 10% return on $1,000? Or do you want a 2% return on 10 million? It's the law of those numbers. You still have persistently high prices, and it's being fueled further by the spending that was baked into that bill. And I don't know how things are played in your world, but they're not fooling anybody here in the Midwest. People go to the grocery store. People go to the gas station. People buy clothes. It's a problem. The way it hit me when I hear these things, it just reminds me of the reports that Winston Smith got. Glorious crane production.
Well, again, I have a respectful disagreement on this point. We agree to disagree. I think that my concern is that I view, for example, this case against Amazon, targeting Amazon Prime, to be not a wise move, right? Particularly for economy. This is something that a lot of people depend on, right? Nearly half the country are Amazon Prime members. Amazon Prime is actually slightly more popular among Democrats even than Republicans. And so I just think, you know, regardless of how you view the economic fundamentals, it's hard to look at this and say people are clamoring for the government to go after Amazon Prime.
Again, when I was reading up on this, I kept trying to say, well, where's the harm? And, you know, like when you first started out, is that the first part of this was, let's protect Walmart. I'm like, okay, right. The biggest retailer on the planet. They can figure this out. I watched what happened to Toys R Us. They clearly didn't invest in the technology, and they got behind And Amazon could sell a product at a loss and the shareholders rewarded them. And you know what happened to Toys R Us. But in recent weeks, now they're, someone said, you know what? People still like to browse. We're going to make a little mini mall with a lot of retail and a lot of restaurant and let people, you know, have a little store within a store, maybe Bed Bath & Beyond, maybe a Toys R Us. And I'm like, okay, great. That's the notion of capitalism. It's somebody comes up with something new, they leave gaps, someone else jumps into that gap. Because what I've yet to hear is, what is Amazon doing that's illegal or anti-consumer? And the argument can't be you're giving your members too good of a deal.
Right. I don't think she'll allege that. I think she'll argue that it's somehow been unfair to sellers.
Yeah, the small business people. Well, look, it's tough to be a small business person. Anybody that's ever been one knows that. I don't know that there is an entitlement to a distribution network like an Amazon.
Well, exactly. I mean, Amazon spent, you know, billions building this fulfillment network. And, you know, and again, it used to, people forget this, and you kind of asked an earlier question about this. It used to be that everything on Amazon was directly sold by Amazon themselves, right? And then they kind of created this marketplace that gave other sellers the chance to have their goods sold and fulfilled through Amazon. And they didn't have to choose that. A lot of them don't, by the way, but it's an option. And if they do that, they pay Amazon a commission fee for those sales. And so I think, like, in some ways, you know, I kind of wonder if the FTC would prefer the world where Amazon direct sold all these goods and didn't have all these marketplace sellers, because to the extent that the case is sort of, you know, going after how they treat marketplace sellers, you know, Amazon could say, well, look, this isn't worth the hassle. Let's just go back to selling all these goods directly ourselves.
Exactly. And for the small seller, it's not difficult today to get an actionable website for e-commerce thrown up, lots of digital ways to pay. And, you know, maybe the next battle is going to be how the search engine optimization is set up so that it doesn't price a small manufacturer out. But there's an infinite number of ways to get a product out to market.
Well, and in fact, one of the things you see quite a bit is you see a lot of sellers, particularly direct-to-consumer retailers, using a combination of ads on Facebook and Instagram to create awareness of the product. And then, you know, they drive the consumer directly to the site. And the site's e-commerce sales are powered by Shopify. That is a very common alternative, frankly, to a seller selling through the Amazon marketplace.
Yeah, absolutely. It just seems like an unusual regulation, and it'll be interesting to watch. And I really appreciate the fact that you're digging into this. As we come to the end here, what did we not talk about that it would be important for the listeners, the readers, and the viewers of The Common Bridge?
Again, I think just the biggest thing is kind of, how do consumers feel about this? We actually, our organization, Chamber of Progress, did a survey earlier this year of voters, and we asked how voters felt about the federal government investigating, particularly suing Amazon. How do they feel about Amazon Prime? And the overall thing that came out of that is that voters felt that there were much bigger fish to fry. And they generally had a lot of value in the Amazon Prime and the way in which Prime kind of helped them save money and got goods to them quickly. So I just think, from set the law aside, legal questions aside for a second, I just don't think this is great politics for the administration to be going after something that, you know, half the country utilizes and values.
Yeah, I'm trying to, again, find that fundamental role of government to keep the private sector in check, and I don't see it. Is GoFundMe one of your members?
No, they're a pretty small outfit.
Okay, they get a lot of publicity and this notion that they're not going to take funds from anybody if they don't like their political views. I don't know if you have a cut on that or not. I know that you weren't prepared to talk about this today, but...
Yeah, I don't know that much about their policies.
Yeah, I only know what I've read in various reports, so maybe we'll save that for another time. Adam, you've been great with your time, as always, and your knowledge, and this is terrific information that people need to know about. Any closing comments?
You know, I think the biggest thing here is that I think it makes sense for the federal government to be scrutinizing big tech. These are big companies. They have a big role in our lives. They have a big influence over e-commerce, over speech, over social networking. And it is appropriate that the government apply a high degree of scrutiny. But I also think it's important for them to, be careful about what problems they're trying to solve. Are these problems that are rooted in something consumers have really complained about, or are they rooted in, I think in this case, sort of a longer held ideological agenda? Because I think the actions will be on stronger stronger footing if they're a result of consumers really saying, we are really ticked off about this one thing that Amazon or Google or Meta does, and you know they're not fixing it, and we really need the government to intervene here. That'll be a much wiser regulatory intervention.
We've been talking today with Adam Kovacevich. We're talking about big tech. We're talking about the role of government, and we're talking about this progress as a human race with technology available to us for the enrichment of our lives, or perhaps to be misused. And this is your host, Rich Helpe, signing off on The Common Bridge.
Thanks for joining us on The Common Bridge. Subscribe to The Common Bridge on Substack.com or use their Substack app, where you can find more interviews, columns, videos, and nonpartisan discussions of the day. Just search for The Common Bridge. You can also find The Common Bridge on Mission Control Radio on your Radio Garden app.